to the Wisdom Toolbox podcast, previously known as the Heartspace podcast. My name is Nicola and I'm thrilled to have you here. I recently decided to rebrand and refresh the podcast to align it more to the offerings on our website, thewisdomtoolbox.com. So do check that out if you enjoy the topics in this podcast, and subscribe to the podcast and our email list for more offerings and tools as they are released. But for now, enjoy. So the topic of the session tonight is going to be called, I called it fake it till you make it, because really it's saying, is there a way for us to better embody all the teachings that we learn and really put them into action even long before we've reached some sort of state of enlightenment or awakening? And this has really been a topic that's been in my mind lately. I think if we just look around at the world, you look at what's happening, just use the Ukraine war as an example, it can feel really helpless to look around and to say, how can I help more? Is there more I can offer? Can I do more? And I'm sure if any of you have ever asked this to any of the teachers, they always give you the exact same response. And that response is, you work on yourself. That is your focus. You work on yourself first, and then everything else can come a little later. But this has been feeling a little limited for me lately, and I really have been stretching myself to say, how can I offer more just in these very troubled times that we are living in? So as part of this journey, I did also share with the group yesterday, we did a similar topic, but as part of this journey, I've been going back into all the teachings, looking at some of the very foundational texts and seeing what the teachings have to say on this topic. And I came across this book called The Way of the Bodhisattva, and it is by a very renowned Indian mystic sage monk from the 8th century who was named Shantideva. And Pema Chodron has actually written her own commentary on this text. So the text is very long, and Patril Rinpoche had previously written a commentary on it, but Pema Chodron, in her very beautiful and simple way, has given a very realistic commentary on it. And her book is called No Time to Lose, which is, I think, a wonderful title. And it's also been released under the name Becoming Bodhisattvas. So if you are interested, those are the two different titles this book has been released on. So I found it interesting. She starts out the book by saying that Shantideva himself, much like the Buddha before his awakening, was actually a prince. And he also renounced his princehood and kingdom and went off to a monastery. And there he became a monk, and not a very good monk. So he never attended the morning meditation sessions. He didn't take part in any of the practices. He just seemed completely disinterested and you know, not engaged at all, which especially in those times was hugely frowned upon. So the story has it that the other monks, either, she says it's obviously unclear to anyone, right? But either because of their desire to perhaps humiliate him, or perhaps their desire to show him that if they asked him to do something, he would realize how little he actually knew, invited him up to give a talk to the entire monastery and on, you know, the right path, the right conduct and path. And he went up there and into this very still meditative state, and then delivered this profound teaching that went on for hours and hours and hours and was recorded and has now, all these centuries later, become a foundational teaching within Buddhism. And really, this whole book is about, what is the process for developing these six paramitas? How do we go from just an ordinary person living in our ordinary life to this person or being called a bodhisattva, which is really a person who has got rid of the ego and is now enabled to embody these qualities. So the six parameters are also known as the six perfections, and really they are just the six qualities, the six categories of qualities that a bodhisattva naturally embodies. They don't have to try and, you know, have patience. They don't have to try and be generous. They simply are generous. They simply embody patience. So the six, just to read them off, the six parameters are generosity, discipline, patience, enthusiasm, meditation, and wisdom. So in this book, we're going to look at how do we actually even get from us having a lack of things like discipline for our practice, a lack of patience, how do we get from that to fully embodying these wisdoms? And is it actually possible to get there in this life? So the question I've asked myself as well, I like to ask difficult questions, sometimes controversial questions. And that is, well, why should we actually care? This seems something so removed from my everyday life. Why should I actually care about trying this process, about trying to embody these things at all? And we'll chat about that in a little while, but this really comes down to our intention and our real true reasoning for wanting to wake up. Is it just simply for us and in order to achieve our own enlightenment so that personally I may escape suffering maybe in the future? Or is there a bigger picture? Is there a more expansive reason that I can connect into? So we'll come on to that now. But I thought, let me just give you an overview of the process up front so that, and this is obviously just in very broad categories as I have understood it from her teaching, but I'm going to give you the four categories and then we'll go into them one at a time. So the first category is we start by developing bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the awakened heart through this connection to an intention. The second part of the process is confession, or we could also maybe think of confession as purification. We're saying sorry for the things we've done, and we try to commit to not do these things again. The third part of the process is attentiveness, which is something more focused than just having awareness. And then the fourth part is how to actually balance our emotions. So these five kleshas, the five categories of disturbed emotions, how is it that we actually can bring them into balance and then really start to move from a conceptual understanding of this work into an embodied form? So we'll start out now with the very first one, which is developing that intention of the awakened heart. So bodhicitta has two elements, and you can be said to have bodhicitta when you bring these two elements together. The one element is an intention to awaken yourself, the intention for yourself personally to wake up. And on the other hand, the other element is the desire to do that for the sake of alleviating or ending suffering of all beings. So when you're able to bring these two together, you can be said to have an awakened mind or awakened heart. You have bodhicitta has blossomed and awakened within you. And the interesting thing is that a lot of us maybe, when we first start our practice, it is a little bit more about us. Maybe when you first come to doing a spiritual practice, whatever it is, maybe you've suffered and you kind of enter it because you want to find answers for yourself. But as you go, what we're really wanting to do is to cultivate that other element, which is alleviating the suffering of others, the desire and the commitment to be there and help other beings other than ourselves. So there's two different types of bodhicitta that they talk about in this book. And the one is called aspirational, and the one is called action. Aspirational is really just having the aspiration to get there, to have these two things brought together. And this is why we say, this is why I call this talk fake it till you make it, because there is this aspect of faking it. We're aspiring to be something that we're not quite yet, or we are, but we we've forgotten, we're asleep. And then on the other hand, action birdie chitter is where we truly embody this quality. But the big issue, Shanti Deva says this very, very clearly in his teaching, is that most of us do not even wish for our own good. We struggle to truly even wish for the best for ourselves. And therefore, why would we extend this wish on for others? And that's quite a profound question. It's something that also talks to our own self-worth and profound feelings that we often have of unworthiness and being unloved. If we can't love ourselves, if we don't feel worthy within ourselves, how can we actually extend that to others? So Pema Chodron, with her beautiful practical wisdom, comes in and she says, here's the thing. Most of us wake up every day and we don't have a burning passion to achieve enlightenment. I didn't wake up this morning thinking, how can I subdue my klesha of anger? It just doesn't happen like that. We pretty much are just trying to get through our day. And that is really our starting point. So she says, if your aim is to just kind of get through your day and remove your key obstacles, you can actually pause and you can look around at the world around and say, yeah, maybe it would actually be nice if my family had less obstacles, my friends had less obstacles, our country had less obstacles. And in this way, we can start to extend our intention, not just for ourselves, but to include others. And this is why it's called faking it or working with it on an aspirational basis. So she says, for instance, let's say you have an argument with somebody. Maybe it's a disagreement with a family member or something at work happens. If you catch yourself in the middle of the argument, that's obviously great because you can stop your habit, preferably before. But if you're in the argument, you stop yourself in the middle, or even maybe at the end, or maybe even a couple days later. She said what you would do is that you would dedicate or you would offer up that argument as not just an opportunity for yourself to work on your own habits, but actually recognize that it's also maybe an opportunity for that other person. So in this way, we can bring our intention to be free of suffering, not just for us, but for everybody else. And she says that the compassion would finally manifest because we realize that the other person in engaging with an argument with us is creating their own karma. They're creating more karma, more suffering, and more pain for themselves. And therefore, even if we are able to see the fault in our way and avoid that habit again, perhaps, that other person is strengthening that habit, their habit momentum. And a bodhisattva would even not want to harm the other person who does them wrong. And this is how it progresses from just being a mere aspiration to something that is just so fully entrenched in our lives. So how do we really change from having this fake aspiration to making it something real? How do we actually awaken that bodhicitta within us? So he says that we do anything that lessens our self-absorption. Any way you can challenge your ego, any way you can look at your comfort and look at the ways that you escape, avoid all of these things within yourself, and even challenge yourself with that. So she, Pema Chodron, gives the example there of even if you're in a work situation, you know, think about it. Somebody says, in any group situation, there's maybe a task that's needed to be done, like a volunteer task. And maybe it would include working a few extra hours on the weekend. And around a table, they ask, who wants to put their hand up for this task? You know, certainly, I would definitely be kind of looking around, shifting in my seat, not wanting to volunteer. But he says that would be a perfect example of putting your hand up, because what you're doing is, instead of thinking of your own comfort, your own weekend, your own free time, you're actually saying, well, the other person can enjoy that and I will take this on. So that's a real practical example of how you can challenge your self-absorption. So they use the example of generosity. Now, generosity is the first of the six parameters. And generosity is something that Shantideva says often, I think especially in the Hindu culture at the time, because of the system and the way it was set up with the caste system in India and so forth, there was this huge focus on doing good deeds and charity and giving out to others. But he says, if you were to see 10 beggars in a day and decide that, well, I'll just give to the first one and then I've done my task for the day, I've done my good deed for the day, he says that is just simply giving with an agenda. That's just giving with ego, because you think that you're actually doing a, you know, spiritually good deed or karmic good deed by ticking that box. But actually that's giving with an agenda. That's not even a practice of generosity. So he says that there are three types of true generosity. The first type is giving your material goods, your time, anything that you hold valuable to you, and letting that go, giving that up to another person or a cause. The second type is being with somebody in a dark time for them, perhaps, so a time of extreme fear, or maybe sitting with somebody who's really lonely and just listening, not there because it's part of your job or you see yourself as this savior, volunteer, or anything like that, but just really putting yourself last and holding that space for that other person. And then the third type of generosity is truly embodied, where you're not even doing anything. You're not trying. You just simply are generosity. And a really good example of that would be, for instance, you know, Jane Goodall is an incredible example of someone whose whole life has been an act of generosity. And a lot closer to home, there is this wonderful woman in Greyton in the Western Cape who runs this animal sanctuary. It's called the Greyton Farm Animal Sanctuary. And she rescues and helps any animal, focusing on farm animals that needs any form of assistance. A lot of them have been abused and really, really bad, badly treated. And no matter what, she'll be there for them. A good example is recently a cow fell into a ditch, like a stormwater drain that was full with water. And it was in the recent rains that we had in the Cape, like about a week or so ago, quite heavy rains. And this cow had fallen in, and they only found it, they think it was already about 72 hours after it fell into this ditch. And this woman, in the middle of the night, it was pouring with rain, it was really, really cold, went down there, sat with the cow, because they couldn't get the cow out. I mean, a cow weighs a ton or thereabouts, and sat with the cow, took blankets, its head was just sticking out of the ditch, and let it rest its chin, you know, stroked its head, sat there with this cow holding vigil throughout the night until they could get a rescue team there. And that is just a true example of complete generosity. She gave no thought to her own comfort, whether she might be in danger, whether she would be cold. It was just purely within her. It's not even trying. It's just so beautiful. And sadly, that cow actually didn't make it when they finally did get her out the next day. But she doesn't let anything stop her. She just continues and continues. So if you are interested, check them out. They have an Instagram account and they do beautiful, beautiful work. But that is an example of how we embody something such as generosity. So I like to think of it as, you've moved now from just having an aspiration and generosity being something you do to being generosity in action. It's just an energy that flows through you. So Shantideva says that the way you can work with this is notice within yourself how the attachment klesha or the attachment poison plays out in your life. So all of us have some degree of each of the different mind poisons, or the five categories of what they also call kleshas or mind poisons. They are anger, ignorance, attachment, envy. I'm forgetting one now. I normally go in order, and pride. And all of our conflicting emotions and neuroses fall into one of those five buckets. It's just five categories. Of course, there's thousands of different emotions, but those are sort of the five main categories. So he says, look at the desire or attachment klesha and see how you relate to it. So for instance, are you someone who's a little bit stingy? Maybe you are a hoarder. That's an interesting one. Maybe you don't have problems giving things out, but you have this extreme need to always be collecting new things. You're always amassing and collecting and buying new things. These are all imbalances within our attachment klesha. So you want to work on that. And he says the way you can do it is to walk around your house and find something you love and give it away. As simple as that. So go maybe look for your absolute favorite jersey or blanket or something and give it to a friend or give it to someone in need. And that's how you start. But then you can make your aspiration even bigger than that. So then imagine giving away more of your belongings to more people. And you can extend that and extend that to the point where you are giving up your physical body, your house, your pets, every single thing, the environment, you're giving it all up for the benefit of other beings. Now, for me, I really take pause when I think about this, because I think, how does imaginary giving really help? How does me giving up something in my imagination help somebody right now that's a refugee or being abused or whatever the scenario is? Is it just a form of like spiritual bypassing where I feel better about myself because I'm doing a practice, but in actual fact, it's having no real benefit for the other person? And I think it's quite a controversial question to ask, but what we're really doing, and Pema Chodron speaks to this, is that we are using our imagination by giving all these offerings to change our relationship with the klesha. So in other words, this poison has us in like an energetic bind, and we need to work to release that energy. We need to work to change our relationship to our attachments. And that is why we use the imagination to give all of these things, because we are changing our pathways and way that we perceive them. Doesn't mean that you still can't, of course, give material things, donations, your time and so forth. And of course, he says that is very good and you should do that. But this concept of making offerings is something that will help you to work on your habits and patterns, which eventually will have an impact on many more people, because you are no longer afflicted by these habits that enslave us. So Pema Chodron says, at first, for us, it might seem like a bit of a stretch to give absolutely everything to every person in the world. That could also then just be a form of like, you know, being way too conceptual. So she gives practical examples. So she said, think about when you have flu. And when you have flu, your body's really sore and there's nothing nicer than having a hot bath. So you get into the bath, and that is something that you now can offer to all other people in the world that have flu, or maybe have other forms of illness or body discomfort. So you can use all these very practical day-to-day things to help others that are in a similar situation to you. So I've been practicing this and doing it in the shower, and especially now as we get into change of season, it's getting chilly, and how lucky are we that we get to wake up and have a hot shower every day? It's something that we take for granted in this world that we live in. But there's so many millions of people who today didn't wake up and have a hot shower, any form of a shower. So it's there are simple things we can offer. The food that you have for dinner, offer it to the homeless man that's living in a tent down the road on the pavement. There's these very practical ways of working with it, as opposed to saying, you know, in our normal prayers that you do, I offer everything to end the suffering of all beings, which is very hard for us to imagine. So before we move on now to the second part, which is this thing about confession or purification, because of the importance that this thing called bodhicitta has on our entire journey, and how important it is to have a clear intention for ourselves and for others, I thought it could be really helpful for us to just take a moment and to write down, if you have a pen and paper, or otherwise I just do it on my phone, on the notes section on my phone or on your laptop, and think about a dedication, intention that is personal to you, relevant to your life right now. Doesn't have to be big and ambitious, just something that is completely real. And the way I've been working with this in my life over the past few years, I've used this thing of intention and dedication. So I'd like you to think of two things. On the one hand is an intention. And an intention for me is something, I even use the word in, it's something that's inside of me that I want to achieve. Intention is like a personal goal. So that might be to repair fractured relationships, or to get over a particular habit, or to work on my anxiety, or to really get into my fears. Whatever it is for you that is something you really, really want to work on in your life right now. And it doesn't have to be forever. Just for now. So maybe start with that intention. And for now, you're not extending that to anyone else. This is just your intention for you. Okay. Now, I'd like you to make a dedication. And a dedication is for others, other people, other species, animals, the planet, anything that's outside of you. And think through a dedication that really has a lot of personal meaning for you. Maybe you're really, really passionate about the environment. Maybe you are called to a particular field of work, such as working with farm animals or working with orphan children or refugees, or maybe it's abused women. Think of what it is for you personally in your life that you feel is your something that you're most passionate about, and make a dedication. And this is completely private. Nobody is ever going to see this or read this. There's no right or wrong. You can be as bold as you want or as humble as you want with it. But just try and really make it something that is going to give you meaning every day. Okay, so if I've rushed it, if you... Obviously, after the talk, then it might be good to revisit it. But what I'd like you to do now is to read your intention and your dedication side by side and see how you can link these two things. So in other words, your motivation for working on yourself is because ultimately it will enable you to fulfill your dedication towards others that much more efficiently. You'll go from trying to actually being that wisdom that situation needs. So by linking these two things, it makes it really, really relevant to you. So let's just say you have a meditation practice that's very up and down. But part of your intention is that you really want to get to the root of your anxiety. But it's still hard. You wake up in the morning, and as Pema Chodron says, we're not passionate about our self-development and we want to get on with our day. But then you take a look at your dedication And you realize that there's such a much bigger picture. There's something else that you're working for. And it definitely, for me, in any event, it gets me back. It brings me back into my seat or whatever it is, time and time again. It's that linking factor. And I really saw this recently. It was the Ironman triathlon in Port Elizabeth. And of course, I had to watch this on TV, which is not my idea of a fun Sunday. But we were watching the finish line, and three South Africans, funnily enough, finished first, second, and third in the men's race, and which is quite unusual because there's people from all over the world. And they interviewed them after the race, and it was very close, especially between the first and the second guy. And of course, that is a complete test of endurance. And I mean, if you don't know what it is, they do three events: swimming, cycling, and running, but like double marathons. It's extreme. It is the most extreme test of endurance. And the guy who won only beat the second guy by about 10 seconds. So it was neck and neck. And when he said to the guy, "How did you do it?" He said, "You know, in that last kilometer of running, it was, you want to give up. Your body is screaming at you. Every single thing, your mind starts to come up with 100 reasons why it would be okay to give up. You come up with every excuse in the book." And it's at that time that he said, your own goals don't matter. You're actually prepared to give it up. Who cares if your goal was to win the Ironman? You know, you're willing to give it up. But your dedication pulls you through. And in this case, this guy had lost both of his parents recently. And he had also had a newborn son. And his whole motivation and dedication for doing the race was to honor his parents and as something for his son. And he said that is just what carried him through. And he didn't know how he did it, but it just carried him through step by step by step. And that's how a dedication, having a clear dedication for somebody else, can lessen our self-absorption, lessen that grip of our ego, and pull us through to the finish line. So what I do is every time I have a new journal or notebook, on the very front page of it, I write what my dedication is, because my intention changes quite often. It can be any task. It could be, I don't know, whatever task or whatever part of myself I'm working on. But that dedication for me in my life is remains pretty constant. And I keep it in the front of my journal, because whenever I have a hard time or a hard day, I go and find my latest journal and I open the front page and I read it. And it's just such a helpful reminder. So this is how we can become, as Pema Chodron says, baby bodhisattvas. We are just practicing to have these glimpses of what it would be like to live our life in this beautiful way. And over time, she says, this passion will start to grow and develop in us, that until it becomes more and more and more natural. And every time you are having a meal or getting into the shower, you're always thinking about other people. And that is, you know, far cry for most of us who 99.9% of the time are thinking about ourselves. So that concludes now the first part of his teaching on developing, starting with bodhicitta. I wonder if anyone has any questions for that part so far, or if I can carry on. Okay, so there's quite a lot, so let me continue. So the second part of the process is what he calls confession. But embodied within this concept of confession is making offerings, doing prostrations, implementing remedial action. And in a nutshell, it's about letting go. It's about being open. It's about being humble. And again, lessening our ego. So a beautiful example of remedial action was encouraged by Thich Nhat Hanh, who had met with the American war vet who had fought in Vietnam and was completely distraught with guilt about the actions he had committed. And they came up with this remedial action where he went to Vietnam and quite literally started working with people who had been impacted through the war. And in that way, he was able to, within himself, find that kind of healing that he needed, and of course bring healing in some degree in Vietnam too. So remedial action, Pema Chodron says, can even be, for instance, if you've ever directly killed an animal, or even indirectly, maybe you can do something to alleviate the suffering of animals and make that part of your practice. So remedial action, you can be as creative as you need to. You know the things in your life. You know the areas where you've gone wrong. And you can find creative ways to work with that. So she also gives a tool of something she calls a life review. And she says it's very helpful to do this once a year. And I was thinking, okay, you could do it on New Year's. You know, sometimes people write, we're very good at writing our New Year's resolutions, which is looking forward. But what about actually looking at the year gone? But I would even think a better time to do it is maybe on the eve of your birthday, because there you have completed your own cycle for the year. And on the eve of your birthday, just think about the year gone and where it is that you've misstepped, perhaps. Where haven't you been proud of yourself? Have you been filled with anger? Have you been engaging in gossip? What are the things you've done where you know you could have done better? And she said this is this whole process of confession, you know, actually also just going to a person that you've had a run-in with and just say sorry, apologize. If you aren't able to see the person in person, you know, maybe they're no longer around or you have zero contact with them, write a letter that you can save or you could burn. Just go through it's about being humble. It's about the willingness to admit when you've made a mistake and to let that go with love. And she says that it can be very difficult for us to do this whole process of confession, because she says we don't see it as proof that we're just human, you know, our wrongdoings, but rather we actually see it as more evidence of our unworthiness. And therefore we feel so guilty about all the things that have gone wrong in our life. But it's actually is part of the human condition. It is part of this world that we're living in. Things do go wrong. Don't beat yourself up, because that energy of guilt is actually another way that our ego traps us and keeps us bound. One more aspect of confession that they mention and talk about is prostrations for people who are doing, for instance, Nandro practices. And, you know, the act of a prostration itself, again, is to make yourself humble. It's about the act of humility. But all in all, no matter what practice you choose, you don't have to do all of them. Maybe doing prostrations isn't for you. But no matter what your practice is, just make sure that you choose something that resonates with you and you're doing it wholeheartedly and not out of guilt or shame. And she says that the utmost key is, this is her words, being pragmatic and using your intelligence with self-compassion. So be smart about this stuff. You know, it's not about what you read in a book and then you go and you try and implement and practice. What works for you, your situation, the things that have happened in your life. And I also think I'm a huge, really passionate about creativity. I think that we know within ourselves how to create our own resources. And, divert for a moment, the author Elizabeth Gilbert, who is very famous for her novel Eat, Pray, Love, but has also written fabulous other books. And one of them is called Big Magic. And it's all about understanding creativity and the process of creativity. Says that, you know, most people in the world are consumers. Because again, we're in our comfort zone. It's a habit. We sit back and we consume. And we consume everything from information to teachings to, obviously, consumer goods, food, whatever it is. But not many people are makers, what she calls a maker, where we actually look within ourselves and find the inner resources to forge our own way. And in that way, by becoming a maker, we contribute back into the world again with our energy, as opposed to just drawing on the energy. So even with these practices, see how you can creatively use your intelligence to develop this practice of confession. So now the third part in this process. So you've gone along, and this is how all of our practices actually work. He's just split them out and gone through them in a lot of detail. But we always start all practices with setting the dedication, naming the intention. We then do the confession. And now we are at the point where we are actively focused and attentive. And the word that is used in this part of the process is called, the Tibetan word is called payu. And it is, Pema Chodron says it's often translated as awareness, but it's actually properly translated as attentiveness, because awareness has got still a quality of spaciousness about it. You can be aware of a lot of different things. Awareness is more open and spacious, whereas attentiveness has a quality of focus. It has a quality of precision that's involved. And that is the form of awareness we want to use in our practice. So it's not just this open, very spacious awareness, it's very focused. And this is really why you do meditation and practice mindfulness, because we are trying to train our monkey minds to become focused. And that is really the whole simple, you know, in a nutshell, what meditation and mindfulness are there for. It's to help us see clearly what our habits are and what we need to do in order to change them. And Shanti Deva says that we want to unhook from our patterns. And he says that there's this thing in the teachings called Shenpa, which is like a pull, a tug, he says, that draws us close towards our kleshas and our habits. It's almost it's an energetic force. He says the kleshas are actually energy. And of course we know that energy is empty, but he says that because of the way we see things dualistically, there's always this push and pull, and therefore even this empty energy has a way to capture us. And when we can notice that initial pull, there's always opportunity to disconnect from that hook. So he says that we can and we must use our attention to become smarter about not getting hooked. And his very famous analogy in this text, which you've probably heard before in other forms, is to remain, this is his wording, remain like a log, which is a really nice image, because what he says is that you go through your day and you might catch yourself, you know, engaging in gossip, or maybe it's in a road rage incident or whatever it is. Whenever you catch yourself or you catch the thought pattern, just focus on becoming like a log. And Pema Chodron says often that can be, some teachers have said, he's promoting suppression. And it's not about suppressing. It's just about stopping our habits in their tracks. And what I think is very helpful is to actually imagine a log that you know in your life, like a log you've seen in your garden or on a walk that you've done, and visualize it. And quite literally, when you find yourself engaging in the situation, visualize that log. And it really does provide this like complete change and can help you stop that impetus of that negative tendency. Because he says it really is like, it does draw us in. And he says that there are five times when we really have to be extra attentive in our life. And I'll read you what those five times are. I mean, to me personally, it almost just, when I read this list, it seems like it's all the time. But this is what he says. He says, we must be extra attentive before we make a commitment, so enter into any form of commitment. After we've made the commitment is the second. When we're relating with the cause and effect of karma, all the consequences of our actions. So we've done something and now a whole chain of events has come off. We need to be really attentive because this is where our kleshas already got us into trouble. And there's an ability for us to, like a magnet, pull more and more and more stuff towards ourselves. And then when we are seduced by our kleshas, so we just can't resist and we've engaged in some sort of conduct that we didn't want to. So once you've caught yourself, you really want to become very attentive and look at what is it that's caught you. Because when we're able to sit with it, and this is exactly what meditation and mindfulness training helps us with, is when you're able to sit with, hang on, why did I just do that? Why did I react in that way? And I'll give you a very practical personal example. The other day I was going for breakfast. I wasn't in any sort of form of a rush. And I was driving in a small parking lot that's a one way. So, and it's very clear that the exit's got a huge big no entry sign. And this Uber driver, of course it would have been an Uber driver, pulls in the no entry sign and stops his car right in front of the empty parking I was about to go into. And I wasn't particularly angry about it. I wasn't in a rush or anything like that. But I kind of thought, typical Uber driver, and I, you know, really made this big effort to raise my hands and show him that this is a one way, like, you know, the self-righteous, like, who do you think you are? What are you doing? And in the moment, I actually knew what I was doing was wrong. I knew it. But there's this thing that is so intoxicating. It can feel so good to engage in these bad habits sometimes. And yeah, we'll get to, he actually in part four, we're going to look more at these habits and kleshas, and he gives five reasons why it's very, very hard for us to break the kleshas. But basically just on this topic of attentiveness, this is why we use our meditation and mindfulness practice is to help us become mindful from morning to night. And in particular, when we see these things arising for us, sit with it, look at it. Think, where does this energy come from? Why has it got me in this grasp? And he said, by looking at it with attention, we can actually see through it that it is nothing but empty. So, all right. So now let's move on to the kleshas. Of course, these things are linked. And he says that once we've now got attention and we're noticing everything, we want to work with these kleshas or mind poisons skillfully. Now, in the talk we did yesterday, we looked at a process that Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche gives for skillfully working with your kleshas. And he teaches you how to be a skillful scientist and to objectively look at your kleshas. So this is kind of the part now in the process that we're at. But what Shantideva says is that because our kleshas are empty in nature and insubstantial, the only thing giving them gravity or power is us, because we are constantly engaging with them. And I think we all can relate or think about the example of a toddler. We've all seen that. You know, a toddler falls on the floor, and there's this like moment where they haven't yet reacted and they kind of look around and see what other people are doing and their parents' faces before they decide to react. So they think about it and then, you know, the tears start or whatever it is. Or maybe they run off and continue playing. And it's exactly like that for us. All of these habits that arise for us are no different to that toddler falling on the ground. It's just that we stand up and we decide to engage with it. So it's just our thoughts. It's actually our thoughts, which are, as we know, just insubstantial, that are giving this energy, which in itself is harmless, the ammunition that it needs in order to continue. So he says the most important power or the great advantage that we have over these poisons is the power of choice. The power of choice truly is, in a way, it's our superpower, because in every single moment of every single day, we can exercise our choice, and we can exercise it in a different way. And in fact, in this teaching, they say this: power of choice is the key to our freedom, which is quite a big statement. That's a big one. So how are we exercising our choice in that moment? So we become aware, we're the toddler, we've fallen down. What do we choose to do? There's always a choice in every single situation that we come to. But he says, well, if this choice is so fundamental, why do we find it so hard to exercise it? And no one would, in their right mind, choose pain. But this is what we do time and time again. We make choices that reinforce our suffering and reinforce our pain. Why on earth would we do that? And he says this is surely because of the habitual, it's a habit. And he says, let's look at the five ways that kleshas have us enslaved. Because if we understand how they work, then we can truly understand how to get to the bottom of them. I just want to pause for a moment. I just want to make sure before I give you the five things, does everybody understand what a klesha is? Don't feel shy if you're not sure. Okay. So let me just get this list here in front of me. So he said, okay, the fault number one is that it has us enslaved as if under a spell. And this trickster nature of it, he says, just knowing that we're enslaved and that we're under a spell helps, because it's enough to bring our attention to it, take a few deep breaths, and carry on. So if I give the example of my one-way Uber driver, just knowing that, in fact, at that moment, I was acting because I was under a spell, just completely out of my control in a way, take a few deep breaths, change the habit, make a choice, and continue. The second reason is that, he says, we actually welcome them. They become so familiar to us. And he says that when a klesha arises, so remember that the klesha comes we come across the klesha. So let's say in the example of the toddler falling, or the person driving up the wrong way, or somebody sending you a rude email, or a million different things that happen just in our day-to-day life. The situation arises, and the energetic signature of that klesha is there. It has the potential now to either wreak havoc, or you can kind of send it on its little merry way. But why do we welcome it in? And he says that is because it has an energetic, well, this is Pema Chodron's commentary. She says it's a predictable chain reaction that we find totally irresistible. Because we've exercised these kleshas so many times, these kleshas have come up so many times, there's this familiarity. We know what happens next. We know what happens when we allow the self-righteousness or the anger or the envy or whatever it is to come into our awareness. We know what happens and we love that. And he says that we can actually think of it as a drug addict and a drug pusher. A drug addict actually welcomes their drug pusher, because the drug pusher is their friend. They provide all what they are seeking. And therefore, we have this like irresistible relationship with the klesha that we need to be very, very aware of. The third one is that these kleshas will keep harming us for a very, very long time unless we're very attentive. So for instance, we all know we can hold grudges for many years. We can hold pain for decades. we can really, these things keep us there for a long, long time. And that's why it's so important to really be actively, attentively, smartly working on them. The fourth one is, if you give them an inch, it will take a mile. So she says, we mustn't be naive. It's not like, oh, I can handle that one. You know, I can handle my jealousy or whatever. You know, don't be naive. Like, this is going to set off an irresistible pattern. It's going to have you addicted and it's going to have you under its spell. And before you know it, something that you think's not a big deal, just engaging in a little bit of gossip here and there, or, you know, a little bit of whatever behavior, can have you down a very, very long path that's going to find you, you know, going to find very hard to claw back from. So here, Pema Chodron talks about, or actually Shanti Deva talks about it too, but we talk about this concept of making friends with our emotion, our emotions. And it's quite interesting because we often hear this in a lot of different teachings. Like, we welcome these things. We want to love our enemies. It's making friends with it. And she says, and this is the very first time I've actually seen it taught in this way, and it was so helpful to me. Making friends with our emotions means becoming attentive enough and able to get to know our patterns better. So I'll repeat that. Making friends with our emotions means becoming attentive and getting to know our patterns better. It doesn't mean saying, oh, well, you are just fearful and let's just embrace your fear. That's never going to help you. It's about saying, I recognize my fear, and this is the way that fear shows up in my life. It's a different relationship with it. Because I think, you know, when we hear teachers say, make friends with your negative attributes, for me anyway, I mean, I'm completely speaking from my like basic understanding, I somehow think, okay, well, maybe they're not so bad, you know, maybe these things are just part of who I am. But in fact, that's like idiot compassion, right? It's about rather saying, being friends with them means, like a parent does with the child, is actually knowing what, being the more responsible, wise parent, and knowing what is actually needed to deal with the situation in the correct way. So she says that, he says that the only way to dissolve the power of the klesha is with intelligent attention. So again, that focus on the focus on being very, very specific. And that was why the teaching, the talk that we did yesterday about becoming the skillful scientist, is a really, really wonderful book by Trungpa Rinpoche, where he teaches you how to name and identify your main kleshas. Because part of this process of being very specific is to be able to know exactly what are your particular kleshas, what are your particular patterns. Because just broad stroke saying everything is, you know, my ego, it's not specific enough. You're not getting to the root of your exact things that hold you down. And he says, we want to, so using our intelligent attention, we notice them. We then stay steady, and this is again where he repeats the instruction of remaining like a log. We then, in that log-like state, we want to connect with the underlying energy. So that is where we can allow ourselves to drop into the moment, no matter what it is that you're doing. Doesn't have to be, all of this is not on your meditation cushion. The point is, this is while you're actually in your day-to-day life. Connect with the underlying energy. Look for it. What does it look like? And then what we should discover is that, in fact, it's actually insubstantial. That energy impulse that arose, that thing that we've decided to, by the power of our choice, usually exercise, but now we pause, is actually got nothing there. It's just an energy signature and we can let it go. And that is how in the moment we've exercised that power of choice in a very, very wise way. And we've just brought ourselves that much closer to embodying wisdom as opposed to just dreaming about it. And the fifth reason for the kleshas, and this is a biggie if we look at what's going on in every part of the world today, is that as long as we're enslaved by these energies, there will never be world peace. So it's, yeah, this is how, by each of us breaking these chains that bind us for so long, we can contribute to bringing more peace and harmony into the world. And then the good news is that once you dissolve it, it can never return. And that's not just speaking, you know, over the course of lifetimes. That's just in that moment. That particular experience, that particular incident is over. It can never return. You've exercised it in a wise, you've exercised your power of choice in a wise way, and it's over. And by strengthening that habit, you will eventually completely dissolve that klesha. Because remember that the only difference between a bodhisattva, who's an awakened person, and a normal person, is that they embody those qualities without ego. Even the word bodhisattva, as I think I mentioned, means going to the other shore, crossing over to the other shore. What are they crossing? What are they leaving behind? It's only their ego. So it's just this continual process of lessening our self-absorption that we're trying to practice here. So he says that, but be aware, when you are committed to working like this, you're going to go through what he calls klesha withdrawal. And you'll have a lot of anguish. Your ego will scream at you. And he gives the example of what people do for their livelihoods. You know, he says a fisherman will endure horrific circumstances for his livelihood of going out and getting his catch. And Pema Chodron says, look at athletes today. Athletes will put themselves through an immense training regime to, you know, achieve their goals. And it is a bit like that for us. You have to know that you're going to have to endure a lot. This is not easy. But again, and this is why everything goes back to your intention and your dedication. Because when it gets difficult, take out that dedication and remind yourself why you're doing this. This is not just silly. This is not just for you. Ultimately, you can make a difference and you will make a difference when you are committed to this process. So I think that is absolutely everything that I wanted to say for now. I did already share it yesterday morning, but I can give you just one more tool that he gives about the four moments of catching your klesha in action. I'll share that with you quickly because I think it's quite helpful. So he says that I'm gonna read them in backwards order. It will make sense to you why. So the first opportunity is once you're already completely enslaved, you have acted out with impulse, you're in the moment, you've sent the text, you've spoken back, you've engaged in the harmful thoughts, and you're completely emotionally enraged, and you know, this is what we always do, right? One step back from that, so you can catch yourself after, in other words, you can catch yourself after the fact. You've already acted out. The next opportunity for catching yourself is when the klesha has arisen, you've engaged in thought, and you've had an emotional reaction, but you haven't quite yet acted out. So you're just at that like precipice of acting out, but you just don't quite give in to the temptation. The third opportunity is when the the klesha has arisen, the thoughts, you've now engaged in it with thought, and you have not yet engaged emotionally. So you've just been churning over the thoughts, but you haven't yet found yourself becoming emotionally reactive to the whole situation. And then the very first opportunity, and that's why I said it makes sense to say it in a backwards, is when the klesha has just arisen and you haven't even engaged in thought, you instantly notice and let it go. So those are the four key opportunities for us to become attentive and to work on exercising this power of choice. So yeah, that's everything in the book up until where he really goes in depth talking about the different parameters. But for an overview of the process to get us there, as Trungpa Rinpoche says in his book, he says, it's just about getting us to the entrance hall. When we can start to do this, we've earned the key to that front door and we can step into the entrance hall. So I didn't obviously have a lot of time, but I thought, let's rather focus on these foundational phases, the things, the really basic, simple things, and they're not actually that simple, that we can work on before getting too caught up in, you know, how do we progress our practice from there and work through each of the different parameters. So it's a wonderful book and I can really recommend it. But yeah, I wonder if anyone has any questions or comments or anything to share. Did everybody manage to create an intention and dedication for themselves? Okay, I'm seeing nods. No, true. Well,
you know, it's interesting how simple it is. And if we just unknitted all our complicated thoughts and processes, our lives would be an awful lot easier.
Yep.
No, I think.
It's true. But at the same time, I hear what you're saying and it seems simple to hear it and then to put it into practice isn't simple. But I think that it can feel overwhelming. But if you just focus on these one or two small aspects, that's why I say, yeah. Write down your personal dedication, write down your personal intention, look at it every day, commit to one small thing, go and give up something, go find something that you love and give it away, and go and have your shower tomorrow morning and offer that to somebody else. That is starting the process. You're on the path when you're doing that. There's no need to have complexity. Complexity doesn't work for me personally. I know some people need that. And some of the practices have, especially in Vajrayana practices, have been developed that really suit complexity, complex minds. You know, it's actually in order to tame our complex minds. But for me personally, I need things to be simple and logical. And I need it to have that realistic, like real world practical application, because otherwise it's just lost to me.
Yeah. I think for myself, very definitely, I have to work through something to get to the simple. You know, I have to kind of sort the week from the chop or whatever sort of other hackneyed phrase I can use, but just to kind of get out what is important. And it's a process also to get to that essence that we're looking for.
Yeah.
In what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah. Pleasure. And I think that, you know, it's actually the simplest things, like practicing mindfulness, has really, if you look at your path, has the most profound impact. It really is these simple things that at the end of the day make the biggest difference. So I would say, you know, even just committing to doing one or two small things is, as Pema Chodron says, it starts to build that passion. It starts to build that clarity that we need. And just think of yourself, as she says, as just a baby bodhisattva. It's just the little moments here and there that are needed. So we mustn't be so hard on ourselves. That's a clear, clear message that I took from this teaching, is that don't be so hard on yourselves. Have this humor, have this lightheartedness, because this is all part of humanity that we're talking about. It's not something wrong with each of us sitting here tonight. So, okay, well, if there's no more comments or questions or thoughts, then we can end and just do the dedication. And even doing the dedication, for me, becomes so much more meaningful, because sitting here, giving up this time, working on ourselves, trying to understand all of the stuff better, we can actually dedicate that for the greater. And that's why when we do the prayers, I always, always pay special attention to the four limitless contemplations. And I always just read them in English really, really slowly. And I don't even say, I change the words. In the text, it says, may all beings find whatever it was, but rather change that to saying, may all of us, include yourself within that, because it connects you again to this thing that we just say. And the same thing with the end dedication. Have that in mind, that it's not just for the statement, but it is linked to you and your intention and dedication. So, okay, so on that note, we can end off.
Through this merit may I achieve all seeing Buddhahood, and thereafter, once all harmful enemies have been defeated, may all beings be liberated from the ocean of existence, stirred by the waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. Sonam diye tamche sepane, tupnene pedranam pamchene, chegana chi balaptro pae, sipe sole droa droa sho.
Concludes another episode of the Wisdom Toolbox podcast. I hope you enjoyed it or found something beneficial within the episode to aid you on your journey. I would love to hear from you. Please follow along on social media and visit the wisdomtoolbox.com website for more resources and sign up for our monthly newsletter and offering. Thanks for stopping by.